I might as well admit it. I was born on the right side of town. My father always managed to have a good enough job, so we never went hungry. And in a land where poverty was very common, I never knew what it was to lack anything. Oh, by the way, my name is Caiaphas, Joseph Caiaphas, and I've served as high priest in Israel now for about 5 years. I don't know, I can't really explain where it came from, but ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be on top. You know, first, when my chums would get together to play soccer, excuse me, or play cricket, I'd always say, I want to be captain, or I'm going to go home. And that's not very subtle, but that's the way I'm made, you know. Then as the teenagers came by, I began to think of the obvious things about a mate, you know, when your hormones are boiling and food my mate would be. And then about a job, a career. I'm kind of a religious guy. You know, I took my Torah studies very seriously. I never missed Sabbath at the synagogue. And the rabbis, I respected them very, very much. So when I declared early on that I wanted to become the high priest of Israel, a lot of people weren't very surprised. They kind of knew right off what I was talking about. Well, the years went by, and I decided to think about my mate. Annas was the high priest when I was growing up, and he had a beautiful daughter, Ruth. And you can see my strategy beginning to form. If I could get close to Ruth and let the matchmaker put us together, why, wouldn't that be a natural way to step into? See, Annas was getting old. He's going to retire soon. So, lo and behold, it happened. And two things took place. I married Ruth when I was about 20, and 2 years later, guess who retired as high priest? Annas was gone, and the Sanhedrin met, and they put the name of Joseph Caiaphas up for high priest, and the vote was unanimous. I made it. And I've had a beautiful wife and a sweetheart all my life, and now I am serving as high priest in Israel. And it really has worked out very well. Well, there's one problem that I have to tell you about that I don't like to have to share, but it's a reality in where I live, and that's the Roman Empire. The year 63, they came in and conquered Israel, and we've been under their thumb and under their boot ever since. And it's a mighty scourge. They are nothing but scum of the earth. And the only good Roman, all of my people agree, is a dead Roman. And all we think about is freedom, freedom, freedom. There's many parties organized and they have one agenda, and that's anti-Rome. Now the Zealots are not so subtle about their agenda. They set out for military warfare. And granted, they're usually a small group, so they're very cautious and use a lot of discretion. But they'll fight the Romans at the drop of a hat and kill them, and ambush them, do anything to get them out. The next two groups, the Essenes and the Pharisees, are very similar. They both believe that God is an active in history. Just like at the Exodus, when the Israelites escaped Egypt, well, they believe that someday God will intervene in history and drive the dreaded Romans into the sea, and Israel will be free at last. Well, the most important group I haven't mentioned yet, and that's the Sadducees. And as you might guess, that's the group I belong to. Come on up here. It's okay. Won't interrupt me at all. Come on up and take a chair.
Thank you.
And that's the Sadducees. The Sadducees were in charge of all the goings-on at the temple. You know, sacrifices were sold every Sabbath at the temple. That was a big part of our service. So that took a lot of energy and a lot of doing to sell the doves, the birds, you know, the lambs, the sheep, once in a while the cattle. So, and all the monies from the sacrificial sales went to, the Sadducees. And if there was any assessment against the individual Israelites, guess who collected the money? Now, Rome may laugh at the idea of one God, but they rarely laugh at the idea of hard cash. And we were hoping someday, somehow, we could drive our agenda and get rid of the Romans and use our cash to pull it off. Well, everything was going pretty fine, and one day one of my spies, you see we have spies all over town, and they report back to me what's going on, just to keep a finger on the pulse of the community. They reported a so-called self-appointed preacher, like a prophet, like another Isaiah or Ezekiel, that was running around town, preaching, teaching. Some said, there was even a rumor that he did some healing. His name is Jesus, and he's from a little podunk town called Nazareth, down in Galilee. And there was one day a rumor that he had taken a few fish and a couple loaves of bread, and with a huge crowd up by the Sea of Galilee, he had fed the whole mob. I know that's nonsense. That can't be true. He's nothing but a false prophet. And the thing that worried me is he kept making noises against the powers that be in Israel. You know, that somehow putting us down. I knew right then we had to keep our eye peeled on this man to find out what he was doing. Well, a few months went by, and then I heard something that made me infuriated. This Jesus, this so-called self-appointed preacher, teacher, had gone into the temple. Now you should know the temple has two parts. There's the outer court where all the transactions and sales of sacrificial animals go on. And then there's the inner court where the worship service takes place. Well, he came into the outer court with a whip and began to drive out all the people, transacting the business. That was our business. He was messing in our affairs. Now, maybe his teaching I could overlook. Maybe his preaching I could try to ignore. But when he interferes with our business in hard cash, I went up to see Annas right away. And I said, Annas, we need to call a meeting of the Sanhedrin and deal with this man. He's gone too far this time. And we did. The Sanhedrin had an emergency meeting. It was very brief, very short, and to the point. And I stood up to get the attention of the group, after a lot of discussion. And I said, this man Jesus is gone too far in his opposition to us, the Sadducees and the ruling party in the temple. He must be stopped at all costs. And after further discussion, it was agreed on two courses of action. Number one, we'd arrest him, and number two, we'd put him to death. And there was the unanimous verdict, and we left, and that was our agenda. Well, it sounds good, but how do you do that? Well, one day, I was in my office, and there was a knock at the door. And a total stranger. I didn't know who he was. I said, yes, can I help you? What's your name? He said, my name is Judas. I said, Judas, yeah. Yeah, Iscariot. He must be from the little village of Iscariot. I said, well, what can I do for you? He said, well, I am a follower of the man Jesus from Nazareth. Oh, would you please come in? Take a chair, let me prepare you a pot of tea. How can I help you? Well, I think this Judas was crazy as bedbug. I had no time for him. But what happened is he said he'd help us find Jesus when there was only about a dozen people around. If you arrest Jesus with thousands of people or lots of people, who knows what the outcome would be? It could be just the reverse. The crowd could react and revolt. Instead of Jesus being subdued, he'd be made a martyr. Instead of putting him down, it would only further his cause. So I was very interested. So we agreed that Thursday night, about 9:30, Judas would meet us and take some temple guards and some Roman guards and go out to where he would show us. And with an embrace, you know, the Israelite embrace, left side, right side, he would identify who it is. And so it happened. About 9:30, they walked out to the Mount of Olives, and there he was. They arrested him and immediately took him in to the Sanhedrin chambers. And we proceeded with the trial. Well, I had three witnesses that I had hired because I knew the trial would probably be coming. I even had their testimony all written out. But you know, when you work with dull-witted men, it's kind of hard to make things come off right. The first witness read his testimony, and it went quite well. The second witness read his testimony. I had it all written down, but it was totally contradictory to the first one. Well, the third witness read his testimony, and that contradicted the first and the second one. Oh, it was hopeless. So I really didn't know what to do. But I finally got up. Oh, by the way, during this whole trial, Jesus never opened his mouth once. Total silence. Well, then I stood up. And I looked Jesus in the eye and I pointed my finger at him and put him under oath and I said, "Now look, tell this court, are you the Messiah, the Christ, the King sent from God or not?" Well, you know, that question would really finish him off. If he answered yes, that's a crime of capital punishment. Either you're stoned or you're crucified. Well, he was silent for a moment, and then he said, "Yes, I am. And in the future, you will see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of heaven and coming in the clouds of glory." We had him. And I blurted out, What? We don't need any further witnesses. Did you hear what this man said? That's blasphemy. What is the verdict of the Sanhedrin? I would suggest death by crucifixion." And they all voted unanimously, yes, he must die. Well, by the time the trial was finished, it was early Friday morning. We had to wait a couple hours because we couldn't go to Pilate, you know. The Rome must always approve capital punishment verdicts. So after a couple hours of delay, we went to Pilate. It was still early. We got him out of bed. But I had worked in the crowd there too, and it forced Pilate's hand. And I could kind of tell Pilate was not really 100% in agreement with the death of Jesus, but he went along with it. Well, after it was all over, I got to feeling pretty good. You know, I'd gathered the evidence. I'd got the witnesses. I had got them through the trial. I got a verdict of death. I got him out of the cross. And now he's dead. And Jesus, well, nobody will ever remember him again. He'll be scrubbed from history. And Caiaphas, I just put myself down in the annals of history as a great man who did a great thing. And I was feeling pretty good. There's one little problem that kind of bothers me. You see, it's my servant Malchus. When I sent the contingent out to the Mount of Olives to arrest Jesus, Peter, one of the disciples, had a hidden sword. And he pulled out the sword and began to wave it like a wild man. And in his running around in confusion, he sliced off the ear of my servant Malchus. Immediately, Jesus stepped forward and grabbed Peter, and said, "No, I don't care what happens here, but there'll not be violence, Peter. Put up your sword. Don't you know I can call on the Father for legions of angels if I needed them?" So apparently Peter was, quieted. Well, Malchus is convinced that Jesus healed his ear. Now, I know that's not possible. He's a wild man. He's a false prophet. Maybe by witchcraft or soothsaying, but he couldn't have done it if really he's an authentic messenger of God. But you know, when I look at Malchus's ear, I've got to admit, that ear is in awfully good shape. And you know what's happened? One night, just a couple nights ago, Malchus came by. He still had a key. See, he's been my servant for about 20 years. And he let himself in, and then he just took me apart. He was very angry, and he said, "Caiaphas, you are dead wrong. And Jesus is the Son of God. And I am no longer going to serve you." And as a slave, he had to run away, but I knew I couldn't stop him. And so he did. And when he left me, I got tears in my eyes. Because that man had served me faithfully so many years. But you know what's happened now? Sometimes I raise my hands to heaven and I sort of call out, "Oh God, have I done something wrong? Was Jesus right and I, Caiaphas, was wrong? Was he the Son of God? And me, Caiaphas, a weapon of evil?" And I guess the question that keeps haunting me is, "Jesus, who are you? Jesus, tell me, who are you?" And I guess I'll never find out until I die and I go across. And then maybe I can check it out. And maybe that's the question you have got to answer. Jesus, who are you? Well, thank you for letting me tell my story this morning. If you don't mind, I'll undress in front of you.
Where's your glasses?
Put my glasses on so I can see where I'm going. Oh, I forgot the Bible reading, but let's do it now. Who had the Bible reading for Tuesday?
I did.
Okay, thank you, Marianne. Mm-hmm. I was an oversight in my mind. It'd be better to hear it first, but now we'll hear it after I've done the monologue. Go ahead.
That's hard. It may even have a different approach, once you've seen it.
I read several, I asked Marianne, several passages, Mark, Luke, and John. Isn't that right, Marianne? Mm-hmm. I omitted Matthew because it's such a repeat of Luke that I did not include Matthew.
Okay, in Mark 14, we read, "They took Jesus to the high priest and all the chief priests. The elders and the scribes were assembled. Peter had followed him at a distance, right in the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards, warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many gave false testimony against him, and their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.' But even at this point, their testimony didn't agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked, 'Jesus, have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?' But he was silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven.'"
You know what? It's maybe better to read it afterward.
Yeah, it does. It has.
It kind of puts me on the spot to see if I was faithful to the text.
But it's part of it. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "Why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" All of them condemned him as deserving death. Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." The guards also took him over and beat him. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate.
Okay.
That's the reading out of Mark.
Okay.
And the reading out of...
See, Luke and John, it's amazing, they're quite different. I think you'll have to. I don't remember which is which, but go ahead and read it.
Let's read Luke 54.
See, one, they took him to Annas, which I did not include that in my monologue. Mm-hmm.
Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. But Peter was following at a distance. You have this right here. Now the men who were holding Jesus back began to mock him and beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" They kept heaping many other insults on him. When the day came, the assembly of the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, gathered together, and they brought him to their council. They said, "If you are the Messiah, tell us." And he replied, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I question you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." All of them asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it from his very own lips." Then the assembly rose as a body and brought Jesus before Pilate. That's the reading.
I think we'll let that suffice.
Okay.
That gives you a feeling of... here's some Bible study sheets we're going to work on. I'll just hand out a practical. And you're welcome to take the Bible study sheet with you if you choose. Oh, by the way, for those who came in before I mentioned it, I've done a book of monologues, and if anybody's interested, I have them here, and they're for sale, the two volumes for $15. And Caiaphas is in there. I've had lived a lot of it, and some of the words I've left out, but you'll find it basically the same as I offered it this morning. I have my little, order here, the monologue and the books to look at. And the smile face means I have my morning joke. And by the way, if you've got a joke to tell, I'll be glad to let you share. Johnny came home from Sunday school one day, and his mother said, "Johnny, what did you learn in Sunday school today?" And so he said, "Well, the teacher told us about Moses and the Israelites escaping from Egypt." And, "Oh, is that right? Well, tell me about it." "Well, you see, the Israelites were going toward the Red Sea, and all of a sudden, they got there, and the Egyptians were chasing them, and they couldn't get across. So Moses got on his walkie-talkie, and he called in his engineering bridge-building squad and said, 'Get over here and build a bridge.' So they came over, and they built a bridge, and they did it real quick, and the Israelites got on the pontoon, or the bridge that they built, and took off across the Red Sea. And then, just as they were getting across, the Egyptians started to follow them. And were going to, attack them. So Moses got into the walkie-talkie and called in his bombers and said, 'Come in and bomb the bridge and bomb the Egyptians so we'll be safe.' And they did, and the Israelites got across safe and sound." And the mother said, "Johnny, is that what your Sunday school teacher told you?" "Well, no, Mom. But if I told you the way she told it, you'd never believe it. Well, I think it's kind of cute.
Pardon me.
Got a joke?
Well, I heard it different.
Good.
Oh, no. They came to the Red Sea and, you know, he called his council and he said, "Engineer, what can you do?" And he said, "Well, we could build a bridge, but we don't have any material." And the other one said, "Well, we could hop on boats and sail across, but there was nothing there." And so one fellow, they're pondering, and Moses said, "I know what we'll do." He said, "I'll walk down to the water's edge, and I'll raise my hand and say, 'Park,' and we'll walk across, and when the Egyptians come, the water will come back and engulf them." And so the public relations man said, "Moses, if you pull this off, I'll give you 3 pages in the Old Testament."
I like yours better. It's more a joke for the 90s, though. Okay, let's look at our Bible study sheet. And I'm going to kind of hop and skip here. But let's take the first question first. And we'll all kind of react to it as a group. What caused the Sanhedrin to be so driven to put Jesus to death? A, Jesus had gone too far in painting the Pharisees, the Jewish authorities, as farcical hypocrites. If you read Matthew 23, it's really very livid. B, Jesus was the only one who was not afraid to stick it to the power structure. Now for the powers in B, payoff time had come. C, it was simple jealousy. There was too many accolades were going Jesus' way. D, the powers were evil. Jesus was good. Evil is never able to tolerate goodness. Other possible reasons. If you want to take a moment to read back and so refresh you which one you like, what's your pick? How would you go?
I think all of the above.
Okay.
All of them, really.
Do you have one that seems to be best or most prominent?
Probably A.
A? Yeah, that's one I picked, too.
Yeah, that's probably where the most powerful one is.
Jesus had gone too far in painting the Pharisees, the authorities, as farcical hypocrites. Because, boy, if you read Matthew 23, it is unbelievable. You know, the way...
That also ties in with number C. It was simple jealousy. You know, he was a real threat to them.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think part of it, too, was the fact that, there's parallels to our own time, that Jesus was a threat to the established order.
Yeah.
That they had worked out a fairly comfortable arrangement with the Romans, where the Romans would support them and their religious institutions. That went back to Herod. Mm-hmm. They worked out a sort of a concordat between them. And when Jesus came along and started calling attention to the fact that what they were doing was wrong, not condemning the Roman authorities per se, because he was not a terribly political individual, but condemning the way they had subverted some of the teachings of Judaism and lost the spirit of the law by being obsessed with the letter of the law, they saw him not only as a threat to the religious order, which is the question of the hypocrisy, but also as a threat to their social order. And I say that kind of comes in contact with our own time because we have a tendency to condemn our own prophets.
Yeah, very well put. A good point.
They had no idea what to expect from him. I mean, there were all the different groups like the Zealots and all the others, and who was he? Where did he, you know, what group did he represent? They had very good reason to be very afraid.
Yeah.
That he was just the tip of the iceberg.
And like a good prophet, political or otherwise, he was unpredictable.
That's right.
Never know where he's going to strike next.
Yeah.
It just seemed like he was just it's so easy for an enemy if he's very predictable. Like Clinton is pretty well, you can put him in a box and say, well, this and this. But yeah, I think you're right. Both the political and the social order were a threat under Jesus' attack or Jesus' program. Okay, let's go to the second one. I'm going to choose question number 5. This is from John. Jesus was mostly silent during his trial. How do you know when to keep silent or when to speak up? Have you ever had moments when you were called on to defend your faith? Has cowardice become one of the 7 deadly sins? I'm trying to pull this down in more contemporary terms. But let's take the first thought first. Are there times to speak up and to be silent? Probably we'd all agree with that, I think. Can you remember some moments when it, what is it, foot and mouth disease? How about it? Anybody got a reaction to that?
Why was Jesus silent?
It looks here as if you're trying to portray that Jesus' silence was an act of cowardice, which strikes me as the reverse.
Oh, I think you're right. No, I don't mean and intend to indicate that at all. But let's ask Johan, right?
Yeah.
Why was Jesus silent? Why do you think? Was it like Phil said? What do you think it was, Phil?
He was destined to be sacrificed. And if he spoke up, he probably could have saved himself. I mean, sure, he could have called it a miracle or something. But that wasn't his destiny. So he stayed silent.
And he was a remarkably persuasive man. I mean, he had taken Peter, who was very cynical towards him and was very much a man of the earth and a man of work and deeds rather than talk, and turned him around and made him a fisher of men. He was a person who was a man of ideas, and yet he'd sway these multitudes of people with ideas, people who normally probably wouldn't have been much moved by ideas. So if he talked to the Sanhedrin, and people who were men of ideas, as persuasive as he was, he probably would have brought him around, but I think Phil's right. He recognized this was the time to be silent because he knew where the shoe was going to drop and that the time had come.
That brings up the issue of whether he really knew what his destiny was. He was man. And there's two frames of thought on that. He was placed on earth as man. There's some belief that he really didn't know what the ultimate end would be. He was living on his life as a man. Although he was God, I don't think God gave him a blueprint. This is going to happen when you're 12 years old. This is going to happen when you're 14. And you do this to make this happen. I don't think that's not, because God doesn't manipulate.
Isn't it interesting that there was this tension between the flesh and the spirit? There were a number of times when Christ did indicate that he knew what was going to happen. He told the disciples, "We're going to go up to Jerusalem and I'm going to be killed." He went into the temple and said, "To tear down this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days," which of course was referring to the death and resurrection.
That's true.
Of course, in the Garden of Gethsemane was the biggest crisis of all, where he said, "God, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me." And then, of course, "Not thy will, but mine be done." Which raises an interesting question about the difference between Christ's will and God's
yes,
will.
Yes, that's where that comes
in,
up.
In a single God, how can you have two different wills? But there, I think it was the spirit of the flesh, which Christ very much embodied, which makes him so meaningful to us.
Yes.
He was human, but at the same time, he was God, and therefore he understood that the will of God would ultimately prevail. He knew what was going to happen, and he was basically playing out the hand that had been dealt him. At least that's my take on it.
I felt that he was silent because he knew the cards were against him. There are times that it's even in today's world, it doesn't pay to say anything, because those people that you are addressing are so set on what they're saying. You're only giving them fuel for the fire, and so you just don't say anything. Just let it go, you know.
If he had answered them, he would have been acknowledging that they had authority over him.
That's true too.
Yeah. I mean, he just, these people did not have authority over him where he was going.
Yeah.
If he had played their game, he followed their rules, he would have been saying, "Yes, you have authority over me, and yes, I'm supposed to answer you."
Yeah.
Interestingly, what he actually did though was provoke him.
Oh, yeah.
The one question he answered was the question, it was the ultimate question. The question that they wanted him to answer, and that they were hoping, at least those who were against him in the Sanhedrin, were hoping he would answer, and that is, he said, "Yes, I am the Son of God."
Right.
So actually, he, in some respects, played into their hands, because after they had gotten themselves worked up into a good lather, this final question was asked, and Jesus said, "Yes, I am everything that you just said," acknowledged it, and thereby sealed his faith.
Right.
I'm processing this discussion about whether he really knew. I feel that at the time, you know, he prayed. He was a prayer, period. This is what he was. He prayed all the time. And don't you feel that there's a possibility that when these events, he began to move into the events, that he was given answers or he was given visions in his prayer as to what the next thing would be? Step by step, he never really knew what was beyond the next step until he prayed, and then he received an answer and or whatever, a revelation, and then he'd go to the next step and the next step because he was man.
It's an interesting, fascinating question. I suppose we've all wrestled with at times, is how much did Jesus really know when he was born?
Yeah.
And how much did he learn? He was omnipotent, he was omniscient, he was the Son of God, so he knew everything. And yet, obviously, as a child growing up, he had to be taught by his parents.
He
had to be taken to the temple. He had to be fed. He had to be nourished like any other human being. So he was going through human experiences, which, again, is the wonderful thing about the whole Christian story. Mm-hmm. He was going through human experiences.
So why does that all of a sudden end?
What would happen?
Yeah, why does that all of a sudden end, you know? Just because he became 14.
I think what happened was that he understood in a cosmic sense, but he didn't necessarily know all of human experience, and that was what God chose to make himself less for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I think it's a circular question. We just don't know either, right?
Yeah, right.
And both of them are right, and both of them are maybe questionable.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think one of those moot questions that there's really no easy answer to, and I think we know that.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting that the three witnesses contradicting themselves was really in Jesus' favor, and that if he stayed silent the whole time, he might not have been convicted.
Mm-hmm. Possibly.
So he, as you pointed out, he said the one thing that assured himself of getting convicted.
He could almost see it going the other way, and he decided, I better intervene here and make sure that the outcome of this sticks.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what I made Kenneth to say, but if he answers yes to this, we got it. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he asked the right question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those never-ending questions, and I think it's a very legitimate to ask.
Of course, it's off the subject a little, but I don't know, you know, from this, why we needed Judas as such. The traditional teaching that Judas identified Jesus to the Romans, that pointed out this is the one. Well, obviously, if Jesus had been this, you know, celebrity down with the whips and everything in the temple, he would have been known to the Romans. Why did they need a finger?
To the Romans? Now, wait a minute. What do you mean Romans?
To the established
Sanhedrin. Judas.
Right.
I mean Caiaphas.
Right.
Yeah. When I was going through that in my monologue, I questioned that too.
Yeah.
Why did Judas have to identify him with the kiss? Certainly by then they knew very well who this guy was. So that's a little part of the gospel narrative that I find puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
That it's there very clearly, but I have trouble understanding it.
Well, equally fascinating is the figure of Judas.
Yeah.
You know, he has become kind of the embodiment of evil throughout history, and whenever you want to stereotype something as being particularly treasonous or treacherous or bad, the term Judas ranks right up in the pantheon of the greats in terms of treachery. And yet Judas was in many respects a very modern man because he could see Jesus as being a figure who was just blowing it. Here he had the ability to be the Messiah, to lead this revolution of the Jews that could have liberated from the Romans. He was blowing it by saying, you don't get violent. You follow peaceful means. My kingdom is not of this world. He's using these phrases, and all of a sudden Judas sees this Messiah thing being turned on its ear and seeing this guy come along who's talking like some kind of a woolly-headed philosopher instead of a military leader, and it just doesn't make sense to him. And so he figures that by forcing Jesus' hand, Jesus may reveal some of that power that he's seen him demonstrate in the field up in Galilee.
The legions of angels.
That's right, and not only that, but rally the Jewish people to their destiny of a new kingdom of David, you know, an earthly king. And so Judas is very much a modern man who thinks in very rational terms about how do we get from this conclusion to the outcome we want of being in power, being in control, of establishing the order we want. And that wasn't the way Jesus thought. I think we can too quickly judge Judas because his reaction, a very rational reaction, in the circumstances of trying to force the political issue here and make Jesus be the leader he was destined to be, Judas thought he should be, was something that many of us might have been very sympathetic to had we been in his situation and seeing Jesus go the wrong, what we saw to be, or what he saw to be the wrong direction. Of course, Jesus had other purposes.
Yeah. When I wrote about Judas, you have to pick a, you know, modus operandi, what's going to be your agenda, you know. What drove Judas? And of course, what, your name is what?
Mark.
Mark? But Mark is saying, I think, is why it often in interpretation that he was trying to force Jesus into a military stance to rally the zealots and all the rest and let's go against the Romans. Mm-hmm. I chose to take the subject that Judas was greedy. He was a thief, he stole from the purse, and it's a legitimate attack, but I don't think quite as strong, perhaps, as the one
that I said. And the other thing that kind of disputes that, I thought of that too, and it's, you know, our tendency is to demonize Judas.
Yeah.
But consider the fact he'd been exposed to Jesus for 3-4 years. Intimately, closely. Now, how could anybody be exposed to Jesus for that period of time and not have been changed by the experience? Now, he still thought like conventional men and women think. He still thought in worldly terms. He couldn't get over that. That was his great sin. But to think of him simply as being greedy for that 30 pieces of silver sells short not only his humanity, but Jesus' persuasiveness.
I realize you got to choose a tat, and that's a debatable tat, but I chose it. So some of you may read that about Judas and say, well, yes, but.
But of course, he went out and hung himself afterwards.
That's true.
Now, would anybody hang himself if they thought that they would have spent silver? They would have kept the silver.
I made him the sharpest in the group. He was very, very intelligent. He was the only one that was educated. You know, some of those are debatable, but they're close, I think, too. I'm going to move on to another question now. Let's go to the third one. Second question, number two. What are the reasons why Americans have become such a blasphemous, focusing on the theme of blasphemy, profane people? How serious is it to break the second commandment? A, profane lips indicate a godless heart. B, it's a thoughtless verbiage. These are harmless and should be disregarded. C, one is profane to prove he or she is with it like the rest of the crowd. In other words, you swear for effect. D, a name is the only primary point of contact between any two persons, God and man, God and woman, person to person, or another possible reason for blasphemy in America. Anybody want to venture a choice out of those selections or another choice?
I would like to address E, other.
Go ahead.
We find ourselves in a society today that is very judgmental, very little patience, and vindictive. And I think that we've come about this. I mean, today's society is unlike any other generation. But we have lost all compassion, and we are really, really hard, especially on our civil servants or anybody that's in public office. We really come down hard on them. And we say, well, why? Well, I don't think it's so much that evil rears its any ugly head any more today than it did in the past. But I think that we have lost our compassion. We've lost the ability to love, to forgive, and to have compassion.
Empathy.
And if I can take this one step farther, and you probably all scream when I say this, but it goes to my right brain theory. The right hemisphere is love, compassion, faith, hope, forgiveness. Those are all right brain character abilities. Your left hemisphere is the didactic, the going from A to B. Everything is linked together. It's the law. And I think with our technical society and all the technology that has come into our lives, everything is left brain. And you have to, the society in general has always been left brain, generally, because we are left brain. This is language and math and so forth, and we're taught that in school. And as soon as we get old enough to go to school, we stop being right brain, feeling things and taking it in within our senses. We begin then to take it in with our eyes and our analytical brain. But the school system sets us out, giving us very little right brain experiences in art or music, half hour a week, not much. And we go into the world as adults into a left brain society. Anybody whose right brain is a real threat. I mean, they're the artists, they're the musicians, they're the people that think divergently, and Christ was right brain. He was totally right brain. That's why he was such a threat to society, because they couldn't understand him. And today's world cannot, they've lost that capacity to love, to forgive, and that's why we're so, that's where we're coming from.
Good, okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. Anybody else?
Mark? My thinking is that we've lost a lot of civility in our time.
Civility.
Being civil to one another.
Yeah.
Part of it comes from the kind of indulgent movements of the last 20 to 30 years of this country, where there's been a heavy focus on self. In fact, a large part of it comes from that sort of selfish preoccupation. Part of it just comes from, as a result of that selfishness, not really being concerned with community. We're more concerned about looking after our own needs. Yeah. And in the process of doing both of those things, you're constantly pushing the edge of the envelope, trying to see how much you can get away with defying the taboos. And one of the ways of defying taboos is by obscenity, you know, by profaning the Lord's name, swearing, whatever you want to call it. It's part of that excessive behavior. But I think that it really calls back to, goes back to, is the importance of trying to emphasize civil virtues in our society that have really gone by the boards.
Yeah.
And what do the children have to, I mean, that's all they hear from little on. Profanity. Mm-hmm. And they become so desensitized to everything. Mm-hmm. It's just...
And every milieu, you know, the TV, the stuff we read, etc., goes on and on.
And they say that's what the population wants. You know, all these programs on TV and this trashy...
They've been educated.
Yeah, I
really think that, particularly for the young people, I don't even think they see it as profanity. It's just another form of expression.
Way to be cool.
And the second commandment, they don't have a clue. And I don't know that they even view it as profanity. No. It's just what everyone else is saying.
It's not a habit, though.
Yeah.
Not at all. When I used to tell my kids in confirmation, when I worked in the second commandment, and explain to them that profanity is really grabbing God out of your heart. If God is on your lips as a swear word, he is not in your heart. They cannot cohabitate in the same body. I'd say, if you're cussed, and God this and God that, and I said, if the preacher comes to your house, do you ever mention God once profanely? No, you clean it up. You don't ever slip, because it's a choice, not a habit. We like to get by, it's a habit, I can't help it. Oh, Mahoney, I don't believe that. Bill, you got to look your hands.
I can't disagree with what's been said, but I'll add one more thing.
Yeah.
Several generations ago, people were quite literate. They wrote letters, they were beautifully done with English. Eloquence. Now we've lost that. The school kids turning out written work is far less eloquent than it was before. And I think that this loss of good, beautiful choice of words has deteriorated to the point where you can make your point strong by using swear words.
You sound tougher, macho.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think it's so much a lack of compassion, because, I mean, lack of, that we're too judgmental, I think it's the other way, because the classic word today is whatever, you know, you do your thing, I do mine, and, you know, that's whatever, you know, whatever goes, and, you know, no problem, that's another one, no problem, it's, you know, the other thing, though, really, is that with the first command, with the first and second commandments, all the commandments for that matter, it's an age of cynicism, and, you know, in the academic world, we call this deconstruction. What right do these Jews who lived 3,000-4,000 years ago have to say for us what we can say and what we can't say? who's to say that their words are any better or worse than the words we choose? I mean, they just say that the Jews were one group that happened to live at that time in history, and there they are, and then you might as well have the Abyssinians and the Sumatrans and all the rest. They just take away any sort of sense of the absolute, because there are no absolutes.
Yeah.
And so they're therefore, I mean, I've heard George, I don't know if you've heard George Carlin on this. He's a comic, and he has this thing about all the seven words you can't use on television. Mm-hmm. And then this is his response to it.
Yeah.
John.
Well, Gene, I like your dialogue, monologue, because you humanize a person. Mm-hmm. You made the person real, made Caiaphas real. And one of the realities that you made was I wrong, or did I make a mistake? And I think that we do that to Pharisees a lot. We do not humanize it, I just say. And we do that in our public world today. We really don't get to know people. But when we get to know people, it's harder to not see them as a child of God.
As what?
As a child of God.
Child of God.
As a person of the community. So I commend you for your monologues,
well,
because they make people see the human of these people. They just really like the human.
Well, like I said in my introduction, I try to, as much as I can, get in the skin. And of course that's impossible, but it's an attempt to try to do that, to feel maybe what it would have been like if I'd been there, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
I'd just like to recommend to the group, there's a movie that we watch every year during Lent, Jesus of Nazareth, the Franco Zeffirelli film.
Oh.
If you ever get an opportunity to see it, it's very powerfully done and really brings the people, is so well acted, to life, so that you really do humanize them, yeah, and think about how they were feeling and what they were thinking. So,
understand their motives.
Yeah.
And it's not judgmental, which is interesting. It reflects the motives of the people as really having been very much like our own.
Yeah.
If you get a chance, it's a wonderful movie.
Very good. You got something you want to say? You're just scratching your head.
Just scratching.
I've got a couple of questions I wanted to ask that are not in the sheet. Number six, was Caiaphas all evil or sinner and saint, like I suggested Zacchaeus was yesterday? Do you think he was totally evil to the core? Or do you think, what do you think about Caiaphas? What's your opinion?
What Jesus was not was that he did not fit the prototype of the Messiah. And that is as true then and as true today. He is simply not the Jewish Messiah from their viewpoint. And so I think the Jews then and today, when they say that he's not the Christ for them, are absolutely true and are defending their faith as they know it. Now, we have a different opinion, but they are being zealous for their view of God.
As they understand.
As they understand. And so how he did it and went about it and all that, I don't know. That's probably his evil side, but and all kind of things about that. But he also was a man who had listened to be with the high priest, no matter how he got there. And so I think all those people have to look at it from that viewpoint, that Jesus was not the prophet, or he was not the Christ as they would understand him. And they had a right, they had a biblical right to push these people out of their system if they think that they are blaspheming God. So, yeah, it's their obligation. Now, they were wrong, but that's...
Because hindsight's perfect.
That's hindsight.
Anybody else react to Caiaphas? Yeah.
It's difficult to be in a position of power. I think every male sitting in this room at this point should recognize that, because God given that we're supposed to be the head of the families. And that's difficult.
With power comes responsibility.
And accountability.
accountability to you. So you could then, like John was saying, view Caiaphas as a man caught in his milieu, in his sort of the drifting of history, and how could he react any other way? We interpret that as evil from the hindsight, but you know.
I was just going to say that years and years ago I saw a movie. It was Nicholas and Alexander. It was about the last Tsar and Tsarina of Russia. You know the story of what happened to him. Towards the end of the movie, this guy who was at one time considered almost like the Godhead on Earth in Russia is standing on the rear car of a train taking him to Siberia with his Russian guard, a Bolshevik guard, who's just abusing him, you know, reaming him up and down. And finally, this guard, you know, and Nicholas is just speechless. You know, here's this guy who could have had this guy killed 6 months earlier, and he's just being tongue-lashed by him. Finally, this guard interrupts himself in midstream and says, "No, I was wrong in everything I said. Your problem was," and this is the most damning indictment of all, "you lacked imagination." And, you know, that really is very much what the indictable offense of Caiaphas was, and it may be our own indictable offense many times as well. He lacked imagination. He couldn't see what Christ really was.
Or like the sermon on Sunday night, God comes through imagination.
Yeah, good point.
To the point. No?
Well, I firmly believe that in every individual there's good, and obviously the possibility of evil. And some people express their evil abundantly, and we don't think there's any redeeming properties at all. But if you think of the popular individual of Birdman of Alcatraz, for instance, and how he had a tender side. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are little elements or kernels of this in every human being. They wouldn't be human otherwise. And so to answer your question, do you think that he was all evil? No.
Who is that English poet, Kennedy? Stuart Kennedy, that says, the poetry says, "I'm a mix. I'm both good and I'm bad," and that's true. I've got a mix. I've got some good in me, I've got some bad in me. Perhaps that would describe Caiaphas too. One last question that's not in the sheet. What qualities, if you were to write, "These are the qualities I think I would have seen in Caiaphas," just sound off. What are some you think you would have spotted in that man, if you had met him?
Decisiveness.
Decisive. I think very sharp, extremely intelligent. I just have to believe he was very gifted.
Lust after power.
Yeah, very likely. A lust for power.
Proud of it, pride of his position. Pride of his position.
Oh, yeah. I made it to the top, and I'm going to let everybody know that I'm here.
Crafty.
Scheming.
Persuasive.
Ends justifies the means.
The end justifies the means. That's kind of an old formula. It has been around a long time, right? Yeah. Well, the last thing I wanted to do is mention some of the themes from, you know, our theme book that Susan and the village are promoting, Practicing the Faith. One would be hospitality. But Zacchaeus refused it. I mean, not Zacchaeus. Caiaphas refused it. There was no hospitality for Jesus. See, he did not see any. But like you mentioned, John, he came at it from a different, you know, eyeglasses. He saw things differently, and that's why that would not be true. Did he have the quality of yes and no? He knew where he was at, yes. He knew where he was at, no. Caiaphas? Yeah, Caiaphas?
He had some remorse. He questioned whether he should be remorseful.
Now that's where I portrayed it. Yeah. We can assume that.
We don't know.
We really don't know.
In your portrayal, he had doubt.
Yeah.
I think he knew yes and no. He just had a rather narrow focus.
Yeah, good way to put it. I think you're right. Yeah. Now, I didn't adorn my body. When Barb got my outfits ready, she gave me a nice, flashy-looking outer coat. I didn't choose to wear it. But we think that he adorned himself with, you know, big robes and big sleeves that hung down. phylactery, phylactery there on his hood and so on. We can't, there isn't much we can do about that because I don't know that much about it. I didn't research. Okay, one last thing I want to ask you to do. What's one thing you might remember from the study of Kidd, as we leave the study today? One thing you'll take with you.
Unfortunately, I think what maybe wasn't in scripture in that is his compassion for his servant. I don't think that's scripturally
no,
there.
No, I've assumed
yet,
that.
What I'm probably going to think about is, hey, he probably was, you know, had the capacity for compassion. And
in my introduction, I call it poetic license,
right.
And you kind of pull little ways
you
of the fact.
You might have to be a little careful about
yeah.
Remember, in other words.
Yeah, maybe he did have compassion
yeah.
for that servant, Malchus. Who knows? Okay, anything else? What's one thing you remember?
Well, I was struck with the fact that he rushed to a judgment without a complete analysis of the whole situation. If he had analyzed the whole thing and gotten to know Jesus and what he was doing, he probably wouldn't have acted the way he did.
You wonder if he ever had second thoughts. You know, I portrayed some anguish of uncertainty, and we just don't know that. That's an assumption. Yeah, I'm with you, Ben. I wonder what he thought. Anything else? What do you think you would have seen in the man curious?
Myself in that given situation?
You know, a little further. Talk more.
I think anybody in a position of power gets sort of carried away and pursues a course that they really don't want deviated, don't want to be convinced to change the way they want to see it follow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would do probably the same thing, unfortunately.
Don't
yeah.
confuse me with the facts my mind made.
Yeah, very well, but I think you're right. Let's join me as we close with prayer. Then we'll be on our way. We thank you, Lord Jesus, that you were there. And we puzzle and we wonder about the destiny that you pursued and how much you understood and all that. But the good news for us is that we know you did indeed go to the cross. You did go through Caiaphas' trial. And you were indeed sentenced to death and you died for us. That we do understand, that is no question, and that is very clear. And we thank and praise you, Lord Jesus, for the way you loved us and went through Caiaphas' trial and then to the cross to show that love for each one of us. Help us to claim in faith what that can mean for us as we pursue our walk today as one of your loyal followers. Hear our prayer, Lord, we ask it in your name. Amen. Thanks for coming.